Gallup. I'm Muhammad Yunus, and this is the Gallup Podcast. In this episode, we welcome back Dr. George Friedman, Gallup's senior advisor and geopolitical strategist, to talk about what this historic election means for America and its role in the world. George, welcome back to the show.
I'm always happy to be here.
As a reprieve from the just flood of short-term play-by-play on the election itself, I wanted to check in with you, George, this week, because you always take a longer view on the U.S. than most. So let me just start by getting your general reflections on the election and the outcome thus far.
Well, it was a tie, and it was the second tie we've had in a row. I say it's a tie not because it's mathematically a tie, because half the country voted against this president, and half the country voted against him in the last election. And that represents a deep and profound division in the country. It's not an unprecedented one. We go through it cyclically. But the important part of it is that out of this election comes basically gridlock. We have not achieved anything here. We've continued the gridlock that emerged with Trump. And some people dread it, some people love it, but it doesn't change anything.
George, you've written in your most recent book about how change in the U.S. happens primarily through two kinds of cycles, and those cycles have unique time frames. I'm going to read just really quickly from your book. The institutional cycle controls the relationship between the federal government and the rest of American society, and it runs its course roughly every 80 years. The socioeconomic cycle shifts about every 50 years and alters the dynamic of the American economy and society. When you think about those two cycles, and of course, that's a quote from one of my favorite books now, The Storm Before the Calm, America's Discord, the Coming Crisis of the 2020s and the Triumph Beyond. When you think about those two cycles, place this election and what's happening in this current moment in America in those cycles. We had a great conversation about the book itself, but kind of give us a taste of how do you place these facts into that framework?
Well, every 50 years, roughly, for reasons I can't tell you, the United States undergoes a major economic and social crisis. The last one we had was in the 1960s and 70s, when race riots ran through the country. Any war demonstrations, the president was impeached. Well, he wasn't impeached. He was simply not indicted. It was a time of utter chaos where many people thought the republic was finished. We're now 50 years later. The period that began after that, that really was ushered in by Ronald Reagan and his policies, and critical to the technical boom that occurred thereafter, is run its course. The microchip is mature. It is no longer cutting edge. So we are in the middle of the transition, the beginning of the transition in a way. The transition was kind of declared by Trump's first election. This declares that the battle has been joined by the enemies of Trump coming in. But the basic problem is that we have a basic cultural crisis. A crisis of, how I would put it, a crisis of norms. Trump was criticized for the norms that he broke. His supporters praised him precisely because he broke those norms, because they regarded the norms as corrupt and supporting an illegitimate elite. So this is the kind of debate like we had before, and this will pass through several presidential elections until the system can no longer support itself, until it ruptures. And that'll be somewhere toward the end of the decade. And then we'll begin a new cycle. And this has happened many times since the founding. The institutional cycle, which is also for the first time bottoming at the same moment that we're having a social crisis, really is about the relationship between the federal government and the people. And that pivots around the question of expertise. Ever since World War II, we have praised expertise over all other things. The experts have to be listened to. The problem with experts was kind of highlighted during the COVID crisis. The medical community knew a great deal about the disease, and they knew how to control it with masks and social distancing and everything else. It was not their job to think about the social and economic consequences of, for example, they couldn't give a date of terminal where it would end. And therefore, it's possible this goes off in 5 years. So that means that some child who's 5 years old will, between the ages of 5 and 10, the critical years, will never be able to simply engage in the intimate physical play that was normal. And the problem is that the federal government has focused in on experts who, by definition, do not consider the area beyond them. So that when those of us who aren't experts listen to doctors, they tell you something, and the doctors are not considered whether that's possible. Can I live like this for 5 years? And this is this obsession with expertise is indispensable, obviously. You have to have the experts. But we've lost that class of generalists, of not big thinkers, but I'd like to think of them as lawyers who used to govern the country, who had a broad view of what goes on and could look at the doctor and say, well, that sounds very good and you should go ahead and do it, but we have a problem. So two crises, and COVID took, it's just the biggest example of the expertise solving a problem, but not the problem, which is beyond them. And at the same time, the fact that, and I'll put it this way, that the society that was created by the tech boom and that's breaking apart. It's no longer new. It's no longer driving, and we're passing out of that time.
The one of the fascinating things to me, George, watching this election, is to really contemplate the system of governance in America. You talked about institutional cycles, and one thing that we found, you know, generation after generation, I guess, but more has really become a problem more in the past 20 years. Is Americans' perceptions of national government tend to be very negative. Perceptions of corruption in it tend to be very high. But perceptions of local government haven't really fallen off and continue to be relatively positive. One of the things I've learned, George, reading your work, is the concept of kind of the strength of a state and how centralized governance is actually a sign of weakness, not a sign of rigor within a system. Whereas the more that the central government appears to control events on the ground is actually a sign of the relative fragility of the state. Reflect on that and the fact that we're now watching, in some cases, unelected local officials standing up to the White House and saying, you know, there was no fraud, or we're not going to stop counting the votes. It was an interesting moment to kind of contemplate federalism in America and how the U.S. is really kind of different than a lot of the other systems we've seen.
Well, we love them standing up to Trump. We dislike it a little more when they stand up for Trump and attack their opponents. We're in a time of kind of political warfare. But the founders wanted this. The founders distrusted the state. The founders particularly distrusted the federal government that oversaw all of the states. They devolved the most important authority to the states. And the states, the commonwealths like Virginia and Pennsylvania, they devolved it to the counties. And the entire idea here was, first, we don't need a whole lot of government. We need business. Second, where we do need government, it should be executed at the level where the people have the greatest control over it. So they created a system. Part of it is still there, sort of there. But at root, our culture distrusts the federal government. And that's healthy. It's healthy because the federal government is dangerous. And therefore, every time we get a president, we say, no one has ever been treated as badly as whoever it is. Well, yeah, they all have. You should have heard what they said about FDR. And it's an important facet of our society, which is unlike European society. And I just, in the interview with European stations, look, we are not a European country. We don't behave like you. Where they all go to Paris, all go to Berlin. As I said to him, one day, you've been to Washington several times, but one day you've got to visit America. And I haven't been here yet. And the idea that one of the things that is not in debate between Biden and Trump is that the presidency has to be the most important institution. But it is very much an issue with Trump supporters who are distrustful of the president. But the most important thing is the contempt with which both sides hold each other. I mean, 50-50 divided down the middle. Half think that Trump is a monster that has to be destroyed, and half think that the people who are trying to destroy him are monsters. Both are sincere. Neither is stupid, although each side paints each other as stupid. I live in a county in Texas called Hays County. North of us is Travis County in Austin. In Hays County, you only see Trump signs. In Travis, you only see one sign. I travel between the two. And the profound lack of understanding and respect between the two factions is extraordinary. It reminds me of the counterculture meeting middle America in the 1960s and 70s.
And it's a really interesting reference because, again, another, you know, exceptionally turbulent time in America politically, socially, economically. Talk to us about, you mentioned that the you know, 70 million Americans basically voted for President Trump. They're highly disappointed. You're now facing a president-elect that is at least, you know, speaking the language of national unity. I know you're not the most optimistic person in the world, but you're also not the most pessimistic. How realistic is it that there'll be some common ground in these next 4 years on policy issues? Let's just at least start domestically.
Not at this point. I mean, the argument over whether this election was rigged and the massive number of emails I get from quite intelligent people who believe it was rigged has to do with the fact that the Democrats are not trusted. When it was said that Biden took money from China or Ukraine or stuff, this is like Clinton. This is simply, you know, a corrupt side. When the other side speaks of the Trump supporters as racists and white supremacists and so on, I mean, certainly there are those who are that in there. But when you take a look at this, the distance is too great. This has to be worn down. The way it will be worn down is kind of a process of exhaustion. We'll have election after election up to about 2028. And at that point, in the same way that everybody kind of said, look, this has to stop. Let's elect Reagan. He's may only be an actor and not very smart, but let's do. And there was a massive shift taking place at the last moment in the polls. And that's what we have to go to. We have to pay the price for our success. It's a machine. The United States was invented as a machine and machines cycle. They don't always go at the same point. They have to cycle down, cycle up. And we can't have the massive successes we've had in transforming our society. Say after the Depression, say after the 60s, we can't have that kind of success without a moment, not so much of pause and reflection, but where all the anger that's built up, you know, shows itself. You can't run a machine at the rate we run without tension rising to near breaking point. But I'm very optimistic based on history that we move past this. It just is not going to be fun living here that time. Yeah.
And that's what always fascinates me, George, about your framework is that you're not, you know, while all other people are very invested in this, you know, is this a time to celebrate American democracy? Is this a bad high point or a low point for, you know, enter your favorite concept of what people think of as American exceptionalism? You kind of see it as this is the natural turbulence that this system creates and grows from. And this is just another kind of growing pain, good or bad, It is what it is. And it's so funny to say, it's not fun to live through. But when you read American history, kind of looking back, it is rather fascinating to think of ourselves in a moment now, really critical turning point.
We're tired. We've come through a period of enormous change. We have seen 9/11. We've seen the United States emerge as a sole superpower. We don't want to be a superpower. We don't want to have an empire. We fought against it. We've seen a transformation of our lives in enormous ways. And we've also seen part of our society smashed, the white working class. That was the industrial class that was so critical. And we've seen other people rise to power and using it in our technocrats, in our universities, in our setting new rules for us. So we have a cultural war. On the one side, we have a group of people who were taught in church, their most sacred institution, that homosexuality is bad, premarital sex is bad, that all these things are bad, who are now regarded as phobic, to use Hillary Clinton's famous words, deplorables and phobics. Well, think about how important the church was to the rise of America. Think of how important it is for the new elite to move beyond that teaching. And you're going to get an explosion. It was interesting. This year, it was different from last year. Last year, all the strength for Hillary was on the Northeast and the West Coast. Between the Appalachians and the Rocky Mountains, only, I think, four states went for Hillary. Yeah. So the heartland was with Trump. Okay. Now, at the same time as we have seen Biden win, Trump's reach has expanded. Exactly. If you take a look at the map. So you have this paradox going on, and it's a necessary one. I mean, we have some serious issues to settle. And religion and its critics is a very serious one. This was founded as a religious country. You go after religious principles, you've got to fight.
I want to ask you, George, about the global outlook. Obviously, it doesn't take a international policy genius to figure out that most U.S. allies are going to be relieved to see just a more traditional figure come into the White House, more predictable figure, if you will. But a lot of the challenges, and let's just think about the allies of the United States, a lot of those challenges remain. The challenges that NATO faces have not changed and will not change because there's a new president of the United States. Brexit is still happening. And the EU, as you predicted, and we're watching now, is really starting to kind of come apart on a level we, you know, a lot of people didn't expect. Talk to us about Europe. What does this really mean for the US's role in Europe, if anything?
First, I want to remind you that the Europeans loathed George W. Bush. And when Obama was elected, he got the Nobel Prize for being Obama. It was an amazing thing to watch.
And then he increased the drone policy and continued a lot of the same policies that George W. Bush.
Well, that's the other thing. The Europeans are focused on personalities, and they don't understand that the American president doesn't have the kind of power that a prime minister in Europe might have with a full support. There's continuity in U.S. foreign policy, and it shifts from time to time, but Obama was a kind of breakpoint. We have three focuses. One, leave the Middle East. Two, contain Russia after the Ukrainian affair. Three, confront China. People forget that Obama's relationship with the Chinese was awful. I mean, they went back and forth. Trump's position was, let's get out of the Middle East and not keep anybody there. Two, let's deal with Russia by putting more troops in Poland, Fort Trump and such.
And sanctions. He definitely
increased. And sanctions. And let's really confront the Chinese. That was Obama's foreign policy. Interestingly, no one on either side will recognize the continuity. Now we have Biden. He's going to have the same foreign policy. Because we have to. We have to deal with the Chinese, with the Russians, and somehow manage the Middle East. Notice that I left Europe out, because except for Poland and Romania, which we have troops in dealing with the Russians, we have no overriding interest in Europe. Yeah, we have some issues on antitrust, on digital law, but basically we are involved with only one country. Otherwise, UK, our dear and old friend, and therefore the Europeans are now waiting for more attention. Well, Biden's got his own problems. Biden is one of the weakest presidents we've ever seen in terms of political support. He's probably got the Senate against him. He's split wide open. The Supreme Court is hostile. We'll say that. He's got a lot more to worry about than the various issues. He will join the Treaty of Paris. The Treaty of Paris sets certain goals that you have to reach. Those goals can only be reached if Congress agrees to them.
Many of which have not been reached, actually, by the signatories thus far.
Of course. It is what I call a great work of European art, the purpose of which is to have the meeting and leave without anybody noticing we didn't do anything. And we're supposed to join this, but the problem is that he doesn't have the political power at this point to do anything as radical as do that, beyond joining it. And perhaps he'll get a Nobel Prize, too.
I can't, Nobel Prize. I cannot resist but ask you about, of course, Iran and the JCPOA. I think asking, is it going to come back into effect, is kind of very naive to ask. What does the future look like with Iran and Washington? Is it going to be different? Let me just leave it there, see where you're at.
Well, the real question is, what is the relationship with Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and Sudan? So there's a massive opposition to a shift in the treaty, not only from the Israelis, but from the Sunni Arabs. The UAE would go ballistic if we changed it. The Israelis go nuts. The Saudis would absolutely. So the only people who might want to bring that treaty back are in Washington. And when they sit down on the ground and they take a look at what it's going to cost, one of the things that Trump has to get credit for, which he won't, he helped construct the most extraordinary event, the integration of Israel into the Arab world. The recognition of by the UAE, by Sudan, Washington, Egypt already recognizes them. This is a very different place. Fooling around with Iran, okay, is the most explosive thing you can do, because the only thing that binds this coalition together is hatred of Iran. So I think when you get down to it, he will definitely make a very strong speech on the subject and then walk away towards something more important.
It's also not wise to assume that Iran is going to sit by and just wait to see what Biden does. They've proven themselves to be rather unpredictable or less predictable than usual.
Well, there's a broader problem. I mean, the opportunity for Biden to have major, unique initiatives is limited. But as George W. Bush learned, the other side gets a vote. 9/11 redefined his entire presidency. He never thought that was what was going to be his presidency. So in the international system, there are other players. There are the Russians playing around in the Caucasus. The Chinese are always looking around. Islamic fundamentalism is not gone, as they've learned in Europe.
As we've seen, last 2 weeks.
So, I mean, the thing to bear in mind is that on the one side, the president has very little room for maneuver, president-elect. But this is also an opportunity for other countries to hit us in ways that can completely transform his presidency. Always remember that Roosevelt, when he first became president, the last thing he thought he'd be engaged in is a global war. And George W. Bush, last thing he thought was going to be invading Afghanistan.
He was lecturing on how nation building is not, you know, for the United States to be involved in. And next thing we know.
Which was, he was absolutely right. He just didn't listen to himself. But
yeah, exactly.
The point that we're looking here is we understand the limits of Biden's policy. We understand the expectations that he's going to have to fail. And we understand he has a split within the Democratic Party between the called progressives. So he has more problems than you can count. And if he gets hit from the outside in some unexpected ways, and this may be seen by some of these players as the excellent moment to do it.
On that note, let me make this my last question. If you got a phone call from the folks who are trying to craft together a China policy, probably have already, what would you tell them is the number one thing they need to keep in mind in dealing with China in these next 4 years?
Well, I would put it differently, and I did in a certain context. It is China's turn to make a concession. Xi has much more room for maneuver than Biden. Biden is not in the position to give anything. But if Xi would give Biden something that he could wave as a victory, there's a possibility. I mean, this is not irreconcilable differences. We're locked in position. That would be the move. The real issue that we don't know the answer to is how much room for maneuver does Xi have? We don't know his relationship to the Central Committee and so on. So I would argue that Biden is not in a position to create any real initiative. Xi is, and that could change the dynamic.
George Friedman, always a pleasure to speak with you, the author of one of my favorite books, The Storm Before the Calm, America's Discord, The Coming Crisis of the 2020s, and The Triumph Beyond. If you haven't read it, you should read it as soon as you can. George, thank you for being on the show.
I really enjoyed it.
That's our podcast. Thank you for tuning in. To subscribe to the podcast from any podcast app, just search the Gallup Podcast. And for more key findings from Gallup News, go to news.gallup.com or follow us at Gallup News. If you have questions, feedback, or suggestions on topics for future episodes, we want to hear from you. Write to us directly by emailing podcast@gallup.com. This Gallup Podcast is directed by Curtis Grubb and produced by Justin McCarthy. I'm Muhammad Yunus, and this is Gallup, reporting on the will of the people since the 1930s.